We'd like to welcome everybody this evening, and thanks for listening to tonight's teleseminar with Karen Scholl. I'm your host, Melinda Garish, and my husband and I own Cutting Up Stables here in Shirley, Indiana, and we'd love to have you stop by. We want to thank all of our listeners tonight for submitting your questions. The topics we'll be discussing are, we have a farrier question, a needle-shy horse, timing and adding rhythmic pressure, gaining confidence and trust, and training new foals up to yearlings. Okay, Karen, are you ready for the first question?
Sure.
Okay. It says, this is from Sally, and my horse acts out when the farrier is working on her by moving and pulling her legs away from him. When he is working on her front feet, she rears up and pulls her leg out from between his legs. When he is working on her rear feet, she moves her legs back and forth in a kicking motion. I do not believe that she exhibits this behavior because she's afraid. Some visits she will stand quietly for the farrier, and then other visits, the same farrier, she will not stand still. When she is relaxed and standing still, I hold her with a loose lead and face away from her with a relaxed posture so that not to put any pressure on her. This is a horse that is desensitized to a stick and a string all over her body and will easily pick up all 4 feet for me with a very slight squeeze as part of our regular routine. She will also stand still for me to clean out her feet without wearing a halter or a lead rope when she's loose in a crown. I hope you can provide me with some tools to use for those moments when she's trying to pull her leg away from the farrier, causing all of us confrontation. Okay.
Well, and this is not uncommon, you know, to see this with horses in different situations. The one thing, years and years ago, there was a horse that was really challenged, you know, picking up her feet. And the owner was so uncomfortable with it that when I took her through my approach, he became so alarmed when I started to pick up the back feet. He was just convinced that she was just going to, you know, really hurt me because that's the kind of effort that she had, you know, put in before. And, you know, really my approach, she picked her back feet up just fine, and I held them for a little bit, put them down, that kind of thing. But what happened when the farrier came out, the old behavior came up. So with, you know, kind of listening to it like a detective, it sounds like under certain conditions, when the mare is in a certain frame of mind, everything's fine, but when she goes into a different frame of mind, the behavior changes. So the question then is, you know, she's fully capable of standing there respectfully and holding her feet up, you know, for the process of doing her feet. But what's happened in that moment, for whatever reason, she loses respect for the human or the activity the human's engaging her in. So it's a bit of a challenge there. And in this particular case with this mare, when the farrier would come out, she would go back to all of her old behaviors. And I went, you know what? I said, this really perplexed me because I couldn't get her to act like that with me. And you know what it occurred to me is I went, you know, what's different? The farrier's different. He's strange. He's coming in. He's got a job to do. And what I was doing was being very polite, very predictable. I was being, you know, very respectful, and the horse knew what to expect. And I went, you know what? I need to help this horse become tolerant of any old stinky old, you know, goofy old anybody that crawls up under her legs and says, pick up your foot, you know, abruptly, rudely, anything. Because what I got her used to was, you know, a very nice, predictable, you know, polite situation. So I went out there the next day and I said, okay, I'm going to walk up there just to, you know, spitting and scratching and going up there. I wasn't polite. I just reached out and grabbed her foot and said, give me that foot. And she, the behavior came out. And she just went, oh, you mean, oh, that's upsetting to me. And I was like, ah, whatever, you know, give me that gold darn foot, you know.
You guys want to hear it?
What's that?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Melinda.
Okay, I'm having trouble hearing you. I hope everybody else can hear you. So did you get through that question completely then, Karen?
No. No.
Can you hear me, Karen?
Can you hear me, Melinda?
I can hear you. You able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm getting some background noise. I'd like to I didn't want to interrupt you, but do a star six now, and then can you go ahead and unmute yourself, and we can get that background noise out?
Yeah, you bet. Go ahead.
Okay.
Can you hear me, Melinda? Okay, I'm going to continue with my answer here. So what we were talking about with the horse is that the horse, under certain conditions, when everything was, you know, rainbows and butterflies, the mare was okay. But when I went up there and behaved in such a way that was, you know, a bit more abrupt or rude or direct, she started taking offense to that. And that's what she needed. She needed me to quit being so kind of careful and soft and genteel, because that's not the real world. Different people throughout your horse's life are going to be picking up their feet and doing things. And I thought, you know, I'm doing all this to help that horse gain confidence, but I wasn't really preparing her for the real world. So that's what changed in me, and it was really amazing. In just one session, I could just go up there, and that horse would pick up all her feet, and when the farrier came out again, she had no problem ever again, because nobody ever behaved the way that I did. And so that may be an approach that you might want to take, instead of going in and saying, okay, everything's rainbows and butterflies, and I'm going to pick up your feet politely and all those kinds of things. Go in and change it around enough that under any condition, hold this thought in your mind, under any condition, the horse would be very happy to pick up and hold up its feet for the entire time. So it's kind of a funny story to explain that, but how you described it to me, I would say that that's probably the most similar experience that taught me that being polite and genteel and all that doesn't actually prepare my horse ultimately for all the experiences that it's going to face in its life. And it was really amazing. I never heard of this mare having a problem with a farrier or anybody with her feet after that, because nothing that she ever experienced was anything like what I did with her. And I wasn't mean. I didn't, you know, it wasn't like I was aggressive toward her or anything. I just went up and said, hey, you know, it was kind of the get-her-done attitude, because she had plenty of confidence when, you know, she was allowed to think and shift her weight and all those kinds of things. But because I was so polite and unoffensive and unobtrusive, anything different than that felt offensive and unobtrusive to her. I hope that makes sense, because you can desensitize a horse to anything. And if you desensitize him to a stick and a string and everything's gentle and sweet and everything, that's why I call the technique of spanking the ground with the stick and the string killing ants. Because I'll take a horse that, you know, is standing there falling asleep, and I'll walk up with more energy and intensity killing the ants, and all of a sudden this sweet little sleepy horse starts levitating at the end of the lead rope. So we get caught up in that a little bit. We get caught up in being kind of avoiding the upset, where I'd like to have that horse not get upset even when conditions might warrant it. That's kind of the next stage you want to take a horse through. And that's when a horse really becomes unflappable, when nothing can really disturb them in those kinds of situations. So I hope that helps you with the question of what's going on with your horse's feet right now. We're not sure Melinda's back on the line. Are you there, Melinda? Okay. If somebody has a question, go ahead and hit star six. That will unmute your phone and ask a question. We'll go ahead and continue with this. Maybe nobody's on but me.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I have sent in an email. I don't know if it'll get up on the list, but I have a problem getting my mare to take one lead over the other. She's very consistent picking her right lead, but the left lead is less consistent. So if there's any hints on training, either when she's lunging, when my daughter, who's much lighter and smaller than I, when she's lunging or with my daughter, she almost always is on the correct lead, but with me, so trying to figure out what the variables might be in that scenario.
Right, right. And how about if she's just on the ground, nobody's on her, is she pretty even?
Yes, and I've had her check for soundness and chiropractor and all those things first.
Right. Well, and you could rule out physical because under different conditions, her physical doesn't indicate a preference towards one or the other. Then that indicates to me that it's the position that you're in. One of the easiest ways to think about leads and getting the left knee, the first footfall, the left lead is the right hind foot. Okay, you can skip the same foot. But the right hind foot is the foot to fall in the left. So it's right hind, then diagonal piers, which is left hind, right front, to land. And the last foot to land is the left front. So if you think of originating the left lead from the right hind, and sometimes it's as simple as leaning back, asking for the canter, don't worry about the lead at first, asking for the canter, and sitting back, even if you take your hand and hold the back of your saddle, and pull your right shoulder back towards that right hind foot and hold that position. It's a little bit hard because, you know, your horse is going at a trot, but if you can think of drawing your right shoulder back, it will shift the horse's weight back to that right hind foot. So when I ask a horse to canter, oftentimes a mistake that people make, and I've done it myself, is when we want to transition upwards, we tend to lean forward. And what that does is it imbalances the horse. So when I want a horse to go more forward, think of your squeezing the toothpaste, it would go back, put the pressure back, and allow the forward motion. So you can go, what's an interesting thing to do is just to go into a smaller area, say a fair-sized round pen, going to the left, lean back, bring your right shoulder back, not your left shoulder forward. Sometimes people think, oh, I'm going to, lean forwards and tip into the canter. Take your right shoulder back, hold it there.
Karen, can you hear Melinda?
Yes, I can, Melinda.
Okay. All right. Good. I've got Mark on the other line. So I am back on. I'm not sure what's happening with the phone line, but I am here.
Okay, great.
Okay.
I'm answering the question. I asked somebody, I finished the first question, and I asked somebody to star six and unmute. So I've got a question on taking a horse taking a left lead, so I'll finish that.
Okay, great.
Okay? So if you're leaning back in that position, your horse is naturally going to go to the left. So you don't really need to do much with the rein. And I want you to feel that right shoulder back, even tipping to the right a little bit more, because that opens up the left side of the horse. So if you think of, I talk about, your shoulder should feel like you're drawing back the string on a bow and an arrow. So if you were drawing back that bow, your right shoulder would come back. And that will help horse balance in such a way that it will strike off with that right hind foot, and then the rest of the lead will follow. So it can be just something as simple as that. And one of my mentors watched his young daughter with a pony, and the pony didn't want to canter. So he gave her two long strings on the back of her saddle, and what he observed is when his daughter would take the string in her right hand and spank the hindquarters on the right side, so the pony would take a left lead. And then when his daughter would change and want the pony to canter and she'd take the left string and spank the left hindquarters, the pony would take the right lead. So if you can get that visual in your mind of where your balance should be asking for the it's not so much what you're doing on the front end of the horse. Everybody focuses on the front end for the lead. The lead originates in the hindquarters. That's why even in a flying lead change, you'll see horses that will change in the front before the hind. That actually is a markdown in shows and things like that. The origination of the lead is in the hindquarters. That's where I would focus your balance on. And really exaggerate it in the beginning until it becomes more, feels more comfortable to you. That's why so many people have a horse that's has a lead that they'll take easily to one side but not the other. It's not necessarily the horse is out of balance, but the human, if we're right-handed or left-handed, will tend to have a stronger side than the other in our own balance. So think of getting out of the way of the left side of the horse, opening up, you know, shifting your weight towards the right side and back to get that right foot to strike off first, and you're opening up that left side so that the horse will open up into that left lead. And a lot of times it's just a little rebalancing and that understanding that you're originating in the hind feet that'll set everything else to follow. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, good luck to you. All right.
Okay. So Karen, can you still hear me?
I can, Melinda. You're still there.
Oh, great. It's how frustrating, because I can hear you, but for some reason you're not hearing me. So, okay, so we're ready to go on with the question from Callie. And it says, there has been some hearsay, Karen, that you have dealt with horses that are afraid of needles. And I have exactly that. Is there any way you can help me with my horse? He is relatively new to me, and I'm still afraid of him sometimes, but mostly afraid that we'll lose him if something grave happens and the vet can't do her job. Let me know what you think. Any advice?
Yeah. Needle shy is a very common thing, and it's interesting. I ask audiences, you know, the topic of needle shy comes up, and I said, you know, who likes needles? You know, nobody raises their hand. And I'll say, now, who donates blood? And about a third of the people raise their hand. So what happens with horses is that they don't like needles, but it's nothing more, you know, the feeling and the sensation of it is nothing more than, you know, what we feel. So the thing with horses, one of the key ingredients is when the horse sees the needle coming, when a horse gets into a flight position, their head raises up. In order to raise their head, their muscles in their neck engage. When the muscle is engaged, it's tight. And when a needle is placed into a tight muscle, it causes pain. Okay? And I've seen horses get so tight in the neck that a needle will actually bend rather than be inserted.
Oh, yeah.
It feels like a, you know, piece of wood, you know, trying to put it in there. So there's quite a bit of pain in that, and that's what you want to resolve before you ever go to place a needle in the horse's neck. So what you ask the horse to do is, it's a very simple process. If you pinch the skin on the side of the horse's neck, and usually that will be enough on a needle shy horse for them to pick their head up, tighten that muscle. You hold that pinch, even if the horse walks backwards or moves away from you or pushes into you, do your best to hold that pinch until, and you may release it when the horse holds its feet still. You may release, because remember, it's the release that teaches the horse what it is that you want them to do. So if you pinch the neck and the horse is moving around, you do your best to hold that pinch, and they may not lower their head, but the moment they hold their feet still, release the pinch. Well, do that a couple of times, and pretty soon the feet, you address the, you know, feet moving challenge. Then you hold it longer and say the horse's head is up, his feet aren't moving, but his head is up. So you hold until the head tips down even just a small amount. So the horse's head may go up, and the good news is what goes up must come down. So you can hold that pinch, the head goes up, and you just wait, and in the instant that horse, the head comes down at all, then you release the pinch. So you start creating a communication with the horse. When you feel a pinch on your neck, lower your head. And it really doesn't take very long before that horse starts to understand that when you feel a pinch on the neck, lower your head and there's a release. When the head is lowered, the muscle is flaccid, it's soft. Then you can take, I use a ballpoint pen, and I'll take a pen and start pressing it into the horse's neck. And it's really amazing. Same thing, all of a sudden they feel a pen, there's an artificial, you know, tool, they go through the same thing, but you just go through that same process. And when the horse is comfortable with that, lowering its head, you can press that pen, the unopened ballpoint pen, and then press, you know, the tab on the ballpoint pen and have a little pen tip. And just go through that process until there's nothing that you could do on that horse's neck that they don't have the response of lowering your head. Then you can take a needle and place it into their neck, and it doesn't hurt. And it's really amazing. In a very short amount of time, I've done, you know, in a, you know, hour-long demo, I've done two needle-shy horses and had horses that were violent. There was one veterinarian that was standing there on crutches with a broken leg from one of the horses. And I said, well, you know, do I have permission? I had, you know, sterile needles from the vet. The owner gave me permission. And in the demo, I placed, you know, 3 needles into the horse's neck, and all she did was blink her eye. And this horse had struck the vet and broke her leg. So it can change that quickly. But remember, what happens is when we go up and we're approaching this horse with a needle or something like that, and the horse's head goes up, we tend to back off. We're actually reinforcing the behavior that we don't want. And we may get in there and try to get a needle into the neck, because as humans, we're very direct line thinkers. So we say, okay, I'm going to hang in there and not let that horse win and all that kind of stuff. But then there's so much pain, the horse says, you know, I was right. This needle thing is not good for me. So it's a very simple process. I have a video that's coming out specifically on needle shy. I think we have about probably 4 or 5 horses videotaped. The last one that we got, three veterinarians had refused to treat the horse, you know, just giving it its regular vaccinations. And you're absolutely right. You need to resolve that issue before you get into a situation where, say, a horse is colicking, needs Banamine, you know, things like that. A horse can lose its life by being needle shy. And if the situations are such that the horse cannot or will not, you know, take a needle, I don't care how sick a horse is, a needle shy horse will come off the ground. Even if it's, you know, looks like it's on its deathbed, you cannot hold a needle-shy horse down. I've seen grown men flying through the air trying to put a needle in a horse that's seriously needle-shy when it could have been resolved in really just a few moments.
Karen, that's real interesting. I've never really heard anyone talk directly about that, so that was a lot of good information. So, you ready for the next question?
You bet.
Okay, this one is from Steph, and she says, Karen, hi, I've noticed that in some instances you say to set it up and wait, but other times when asking for the same maneuver, you will add the rhythmic pressure sooner to encourage the horse to move sooner. How do you know when to set it up and wait and when not to?
You don't. That's the quick answer. And I wish I could tell you, it's kind of like when you're raising kids. How do you know when to get a more immediate response, and how do you know when the child just needs more time to have a little more thought and get more confident in it? It's a gut feeling. And I tell people the best advice that I can give you about horses is to trust your gut feeling. And the honest to goodness truth is, you know, we all, to some element, you know, we don't want to make a mistake. We don't want to do it wrong. It's really about, you know, try it. You're in a learning stage, you know, always with horses. I don't care how much experience. I'm in the learning stage. I learn things all the time from how these horses respond to me. And sometimes, to be honest, your timing is too early. Your release is too late. You should have asked for more, asked for less, or waited longer, or not waited longer. And the best advice I can give you is trust your gut feeling. We don't trust our gut enough. We want the instructions so that we'll do it right. And it's just not possible. I can give you all the advice in the world, but when you're just out there and it's you and your horse, and you're going, okay, I'm looking for a specific result, I don't know when to ask for more, when to ask for less. So here's another thing that you can observe, Steph, is observe how horses communicate with each other. And it's funny because you don't see horse A, that say is the lead horse, go up and, you know, go through stages, you know, stage 1, then wait for stage 2 and the immediacy of the relief. You know, you don't see the lead horse out there overthinking the whole thing. The lead horse goes out there and says, hey, I'm crossing this pasture to go to the water, and you just happen to be in the way. So the horse-to-horse communication is your ideal example of application of pressure, clear communication, following through, all of those things. So, but the lead horse is never angry. There's no emotion to it. They are simply moving through their world with their thought in their mind, and the other horses respect that and move out of their way. But it creates an attraction to follow them at the same time. So the truth of it is, and it doesn't matter what any advice you ever hear, the honest to goodness truth is, you don't know. You try it, you observe the response, and try something else. And just keep practicing with it. Being willing to make mistakes is a key element in learning anything. You cannot learn a skill without the willingness to make mistakes. And the wonderful thing about horses, I tell people, you get do-overs. You get do-overs. And the moment you get it right, the horse will get it right. So the horse is really your feedback mechanism to say whether you're being effective or not. And it really is just, you know, kind of a fake it till you make it until, boy, all of a sudden your communication comes across clearly, your horse understands. And to be honest, some horses, I was in Maine this last weekend teaching a clinic, and there was a horse there that got me thinking, okay, should I, you know, people say, well, you know, you back down and offer, you know, the politest response, less is more, you know, is a fairly common thing. And then, you know, I'll step up and say, hey, but I need you to try. You know, and I'll deliver a monocyte. And this horse had me all over the range of requests to find what was most effective with her. And, you know, that's a more challenging horse. That horse brought out, you know, I felt like Ninja Woman, you know, with this horse. And I was helping the owner, you know, quite a bit because she was in the very early learning stages. She was a first-time horse owner and bought a horse that has been in the lead position in her world for most of her life. So she was vying for the leadership position with a very conditioned lead horse and trying to earn that leadership in that situation. But I told her, I said, don't worry about it. You've got all the time in the world. And it doesn't mean that she won't try to get the leadership back from you, but she'll just get you better and better and better at your skill set of communication with her.
Okay. Steph, we'd like to thank you for submitting that question. Also, Karen, is there a video out on the rhythmic pressure if she would like to maybe look at that and kind of look at the techniques there as well? Which video would you go to for that?
Well, really the all the videos. You know, that's been my answer to people say, well, which video? And if I tell you one video, another video might be the piece of information that will save your life in another situation. So, you know, get the education, invest in the education. But the first three videos I recommend for people is the three-pack. It's the Cornerstone for Communication, Writing from the Ground, and Writing from Above. And watch that. I told that woman at the clinic, she bought the videos. I said, I want you to wear them out. I'll send you new ones. I said, you wear these out, because she needed to get that skill set up as quickly as possible because she was actually in a very dangerous situation with a horse that when she's, you know, vying for leadership, this horse had more moves than, you know, Ninja Woman. So, I mean, she challenged my skill set. So that's what I would recommend.
Okay. Okay, so we're ready for the next question then. So this one says, Dear Karen, I enjoyed your article in The Horse and Rider about confidence in women. I have had my horse for 4 years now, and I still get a little nervous riding by myself. My horse is great and listens well, so how do I become confident and trust in him? I have your DVDs. My husband bought them for me. Thank you. And so I guess that's her question there.
Question is, how do you gain more confidence with your horse? It sounds like your horse, is going along pretty well, respectful, you know, listens to your communications and aids. What I would do in the riding part, I'd get even more skill on the ground. Where we get more confidence with horses is when our communication, our both ways, we start to understand the horse more, we start being able to read the horse's behavior, their expression, and the horse starts to be able to read us. That's one of the things I really emphasize in my clinics and courses is that, you know, it's wonderful to be able to read the horse. And you can look at about any horse and get an impression of what they're feeling or thinking at that moment. What I want to teach people to do is how to become so clear in your communication that your horse understands you, even in duress. So my advice would be, if you can get to a clinic, come with your horse to a hands-on clinic, and I can help you in those situations. And like I told the group in Maine this last weekend, you know, all I'm doing during the clinic is putting you and your horse into little mini disasters. You know, I'll take a bag or a something unexpected, a barrel or a crack of stock whip or something that you wouldn't necessarily put yourself into, a situation you wouldn't put yourself into, and then that reinforces the behavior and the communication between you and your horse under those conditions. So when something happens out on the trail or unexpected, nobody wants anything unexpected to happen, but it does. I don't even say if it does. I say when it does. You will have the muscle memory to do the right thing in those situations. That's where we lose confidence, because our survival mechanism kicks in and it says, you know what, the muscle memory is not there yet to do the right thing when the unexpected happens. And so what fear does and lack of confidence tends to make us avoid those situations, so we don't put ourselves in those situations. So a lot of people will end up, you know, riding in an arena and not outside and never alone, maybe not even go into a canter ever. I know lots of people that will say, I do not canter my horse. I knew a woman had a horse for more than 20 years, raised it from a baby, had never cantered on its back. And when we got done through our series of exercises over 3 days, she was cantering and didn't even realize it. She became a cantering queen because her body changed, her muscle memory practiced the maneuvers enough that she felt comfortable and confident doing that. That's, if you parallel something to an activity, say snow skiing, you get up there on the mountain, everything inside of you, your survival mechanism is don't go down this mountain. But if an instructor is along and they take you through the stages of how to stop those skis, if you have that ability, then your body starts saying, you know what, this is fun to allow myself to go down this mountain because I know how to stop. I have the muscle memory to change the conditions, you know, change what I'm doing to be able to stop in this example. So the better you are at that skill set, the more fun it is to participate in that activity. So that's what's going on, is your body is saying you need to get more muscle memory to do those things. So that's what I would do. I would keep watching those videos. I keep challenging yourself. I keep asking for more from your horse, doing different things with tarps or barrels or, you know, anything that you can imagine. Go get little packing, the little bubble wrap packing thing, and have your horse walk across that and make all the little bubbles pop. You know, once you allow your horse to
know that situation.
I've heard that one. Yeah, and the horse sees that you know how to handle the situation. That's when your confidence starts to really gain strength. Because, you've walked across bubble wrap. You know, what else? What could you run into, you know, out on your trail ride that's going to be more challenging than that? So that's how you start developing more confidence, by creating more challenge between you and your horse, you know, in a safe, effective way.
Okay. Well, great. Well, we'll have to try the bubble wrap. I haven't tried that one yet, Karen.
It's a good one.
I bet. Yeah, that'll I'll let you know. So, okay. Well, we've got a question from Linda. And Linda says, I breed horses, and could I request that Karen address issues with training new foals up to yearling age? And also says, P.S., I'm watching Karen's new TV program with several friends, and we all like it.
Great. That's good. Well, the television show has aired over these last 4 weeks, and we've had really wonderful response from it. It's in the educational channels on Dish Network. It's 94.11, and it's on Saturday and Sunday mornings. It repeats on Saturday and Sunday, and it's 8 a.m. Pacific time. So it's an hour apart, of course, across the country. But we've been getting some wonderful feedback from that. We just filmed some more episodes yesterday, several episodes yesterday.
Now,
so
Karen,
we'll keep building on that.
What is the name of that show?
The channel is called University House.
Okay, that's what I couldn't remember.
And there's
University House.
Yes. University House. And there are several shows of horse, specifically of horse programming, on that. On that channel, and they're going to be expanding it even more. So be sure to watch that. It's a wonderful channel, but it is in the educational channels. It's up in the 9000 numbers, 9411, which
okay.
is where horses programming should be, an educational channel.
Yeah, and Mark was
so in answer to your question about foals to yearlings, how I like to think about it, and please know that prey animals, according to Dr. Robert Miller, who developed foal imprinting, prey animals' minds are fully functional at the moment of birth. Okay, it's not like puppies and kittens and human babies where, you know, we're not functional. We have to live in the protection of a den. The mother brings our food into us. And all we do, you know, puppies and kittens' eyes are closed, their ears are closed. All they really do is nurse and sleep until they're getting big enough. When they get to about 6 weeks of age, puppies and kittens start exploring their world. They're seeing things. That's when the peak learning starts happening with predator species. Prey animal species are different. They have a mind that is fully functional at the moment of birth because when they are born, they have to hit the ground running. Within a short amount of time, foals have to be standing and keeping up as fast as the herd. The herd doesn't go, oh, we have a new foal today, let's all slow down. That foal has to go over the terrain and the speed and the direction that the herd does in order for survival. So their brains are fully functional. The mistake that we make because we're a predator species is we tend to treat them like sweetie little baby foals. And these foals, if they're handled like that, with that approach, will become very disrespectful of the human, will walk all over the place, and some of the most challenging horses that I've ever had in clinics where people will say, and I'll interact with this horse. The horse is looking at me like, who do you think you are? And I said, well, I'm, you know, looking to be a leader in your life, and that horse is just going, forget it. You know, you got two legs and a twig. What are you going to do? And it's funny. I'll ask the people, I'll go, did you raise this horse by any chance? And they go, oh, yes, we did. How did you know that? And I'll go, I wonder how I knew that. And the even more challenging horse, there's only one that's slightly more challenging, and that's the orphan horse. That horse has not even had a good mother in its life to teach it boundaries. So it can be very challenging, and that's where foal imprinting gets a bad rap. Because what the human tends to do is to say, okay, I'm going to imprint this foal. That happens within the first 2 hours of birth. And people will say, well, that turns it into a barnyard pet. You know, stay away from that. Don't do that. And it can if that's all you do. But that's not what the mother does. The mother touches that foal, licks it all over, touches it all over, has that exchange of familiarity in that first 2 hours of birth. Then then the approach changes. The mother starts nipping the foal to get up. She doesn't nudge little baby Junior to get up. The teeth come into play, and the nipping starts to happen, and that's what gets a foal up and on its feet. So it's the same thing for humans. If you approach a foal and try to treat it like a little sweetie baby foal, you can actually cause more harm than good because it becomes so familiar, and there's a, you know, very old saying, familiarity breeds contempt. And that's oftentimes what happens with these young horses. So they need the element of respect, just like a good mother would teach that foal. When that foal's out of line, she communicates that. And most people have been around a foal. You'll see a foal all of a sudden one day, for whatever reason, he takes off from its mother. And that mother, well, she just goes, wow, I'm going to... She chases after him, and she comes barreling down on him, and that little foal will look back and go, uh-oh, and she'll nip him hard right on the hindquarters. And that foal will turn around, pop his mouth in submission, and say, sorry, Mom, and she says, fall in, Junior. Fall in, and don't you run away from me, because running away from the mare could be a fatal decision for a foal. But a foal doesn't know that. It's just like small children. They don't know that running away from Mom or running into a street could be fatal for them. And that's where mothers, you know, all of a sudden your awareness starts to shift, you know, and it scares us. You know, even if there's no car in sight, you see a toddler go take off into the street, our reaction is as if a car were barreling down on him, because that child needs to know under no uncertain terms, you step off the curb. We have to be taught to look both ways. So a good mother will do those things. So foal imprinting, I recommend it with this in mind, because when you imprint a foal, the prey-predator barrier never forms. Okay, the the little fold never views the human as a predator species. That's the benefit of it. But that's all you do is gentle the baby, gentle, oh, sweet baby, all that. You can turn them into, you know, something that if it were on human terms, it'd be on Super Nanny, you know. And if that's on fixed, you see it on Jerry Springer, you know, when he gets older. You don't want those disrespectful behaviors. So observe what a mare does with a young horse. So that's what I teach people to do. Use the cornerstone for communication and the riding from the ground. And teach a foal. You can teach a foal to do everything a grown horse can do within the first few weeks of life. Walk across tarps, go under tarps, do different things, move out of my personal space, deliver a mama's bite, you know, all of those things. I don't do lunging with young horses. It's lunging in circles is not a natural maneuver for horses, so it puts too much torque on the joints. But you can do all of those things, lots of straight lines, moving in lots of directions, turning, following a feel. You can put a little rope in their mouth and make a little, you know, what will one day be a bit. For that horse, it's the sky is the limit. It's only limited to your imagination. But remember, you don't want a horse to get so familiar with you where you just over-gentle them to now where they won't move for you. It needs to be a balance of both. And you could take a horse. I like to have a horse just for the first few weeks of life, learn all of these things, and then turn them out with their mothers. Ideal is on uneven terrain. Out in the big, you know, paddock field where they have to climb up hills, run down hills, develop a wonderful self-carriage at a very young age, and leave them alone. You don't have to go out there once a week or anything. They will remember everything you've ever taught them for the rest of their life. So according to Dr. Miller, a horse has a memory second only to an elephant. Remember everything. And then just leave them alone. Let them go be a horse. So you've got the balance. It's mama's going to teach them, and the things that it will come back to and need to know in the human world as well.
Okay. Well, thanks, Karen, and thanks, Linda, for submitting that question. Karen, that's all the questions that we have for this evening. Do you have any upcoming events that you would like to tell us about?
Hey. Oh, all kinds of things. We're booked through the end of the year. I'm headed to Montana tomorrow. I've got a clinic in Sheridan, Montana. And I'll fly into Billings tomorrow, and a wonderful gal there. This was really an amazing example. A woman read the article in Horse and Rider this month and called up and said, you know, when is Karen coming to Montana? I didn't have anything on the schedule, but I had an open weekend. And she said, well, I'm going to contact my friends and hold this clinic. And Sheridan, Montana has a population of 700 people. And she called back and said, you know, I can't quite get my friends together, but I want this so bad. She arranged for the clinic for herself. And I went, wow, this was, she is serious. She said, you know, I need the help. This is an opportunity. I don't want to wait till next year. I'm not going to let the disinterest of other people ruin my level of interest. And it was really amazing. Just in a few weeks, she's got some people coming, and she's really making it happen in a very small town. So it's really amazing to me when people have that kind of desire that they'll make things happen, and regardless of what's going on around them. So she's quite an inspiration, I think, for everyone. When the desire is high enough, you'll make something happen for yourself. So, and then at the end of the month, two weekends after that, there's a Prescott demonstration at College in Prescott the following week. I come back for that. And then the week after that, I go to Northern Illinois Horse Fair in Belvedere, Illinois. And that's over 3 days. It's a Friday, Saturday. Sorry, it's over 2 days. It's Saturday and Sunday. And I'll be one of the speakers there and doing demonstrations with horses with different challenges and problems. And we've been to that horse fair before, and we just absolutely have a ball. If you're not familiar with horse fairs, they're a wonderful opportunity. You'll see booths of every kind of horse product that you can imagine. You'll see lots of different speakers. You'll see veterinarians, farriers. It's a wonderful place to network with people in the industry. So, you know, I go to some, actually the horse fair there in Indiana where I met you, Melinda, was amazing. People come back every year and reconnect with their friends you know, on once a year on that weekend, maybe the only time they see them. But it's a wonderful place to reconnect and meet new people, people that have similar interests or even new interests. You'll, maybe you trail ride with your horse all the time and you get together with a riders that you hadn't otherwise would not have had an opportunity to meet. So it's a wonderful place to and reconnect with people. So, yeah, then I go into Colorado, into Grand Junction, Cortez the following week, Ignacio, there's another Rock Mountain Horse Expo. I'll be down there, and so we just do the Colorado tour after that. So we're just staying busy and on the road and helping lots of people with their horses. It's really an amazing experience. No matter where I go in this country, there are people with the biggest hearts and the greatest desire to have their horse have the best life possible by them having the most effective communication that they can provide to their horse. Because regardless of what you're doing, whether it's trail riding, it's feeding time, it's farrier, you know, any of those things, it's all about how can your horse better understand you in your request in that moment. So it's really, I just feel so fortunate to be able to help people with that aspect of their horsemanship. I can't believe I do this for a living. It's amazing.
Well, Karen, we thank you for taking time to answer these questions tonight and taking time to go out and go to these places and help all of us. We really appreciate that. So for those that haven't checked out your TV show, if you're not able to get the 9411, Mark was telling me you can call Dish Network if you've got them, and they may be able to add that channel there. So don't give up. I wasn't aware of that, so you may still be able to get it. You just need to call them, and they may be able to add that.
Yeah, on DirecTV, we're working with the channel there because they have three channels that broadcast on Dish 24/7, and we've told them, you know, had that feedback that, you know, quite a few people have DirecTV, and so we're working with them on how to get that request in to get it. You know, to get that channel added to DirecTV as well.
Okay, well, great. So, well, Karen, I think that's about all the time that we had tonight. Unless you have anything else, we'd like to have everyone join us again for the next teleseminar on September the 9th. And we thank everyone that has sent us the questions. And remember to submit your questions for next month to canwetalk@karenscholl.com. And Karen, thanks again for taking time this evening to answer everyone's questions.